Case number 09-1021 et al. American Equity Investment Life Insurance Company et al. Petitioners versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Scalia for petitioners, American Equity Investment Life Insurance Company et al. Mr. Page for petitioner, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and Mr. Connolly for the respondents.
I guess it's quite a disappointment to all of the clerks that no one left when you got through being sworn in. And you probably thought you drew this crowd for your admission ceremony. Good morning, Mr. Scalia.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The rule in issue here was proposed by the Securities and Exchange Commission in the belief that fixed indexed annuities, or what I'll call FIAs, were subject to widespread sales abuses that were not addressed by state law. The comment period showed both those premises to be flawed and showed as well that this rule could cost as much as $2 billion, put businesses out of work, and leave people unemployed. The commission finalized the rule nonetheless, claiming that these requirements must be imposed as a matter of law. We ask this court to recognize that fixed indexed annuities are annuities exempt from SEC regulation as a matter of law and to vacate this rule. And I would note that the SEC has not opposed vacating the rule if the petition is granted. And indeed, we believe that the reasons set forth in our emergency motion for expedited review, which this court granted, further warrant vacating the rule in the event the petition is granted. I'd like to begin by addressing the subject of deference, but let me be clear at the outset. We believe this rule should be invalidated under any standard because it's an impermissible encroachment on the an area reserved to the authority of the states, and it rests on theories hatched in the SEC's offices about annuities that conflict with the reality of those products and conflict as well with Supreme Court precedent and the rulemaking record. As to deference, this case closely resembles the American Bankers case, another instance in which this court invalidated an SEC rule because the agency attempted to expand its jurisdiction by defining a term that by definition was outside of its authority and tried to use that as a mechanism of encroaching on the authority of another regulatory body. That's precisely what's occurred here. Indeed, we have the extraordinary circumstance of 50 state insurance commissioners saying that they know annuities, they're the expert in annuities, and this is an encroachment.
I don't understand. The Supreme Court has made clear that the fact of state enforcement doesn't provide necessarily the type of protections that the 1933 Act was designed to protect. And I don't think that's disputed in the briefs before us. Some states do some things, some states do other things.
Actually, Judge Rogers, that's a significant difference between this case and the VALIC and the United Benefit cases. In both of those cases, the Supreme Court did take a look at state law. And in VALIC, it said, well, the states aren't in agreement on whether these are annuities. And in United Benefit, it said, these products exist by virtue of an exemption from state insurance laws. It's exactly the opposite here. That's one of the things that makes this case so extraordinary. These products meet every requirement under the state insurance laws, and they're uniformly recognized to be regular annuities, and yet the SEC is attempting to regulate them nonetheless. That's the difference. But in terms of the deference point, what I also would add is that McCarran-Ferguson establishes what the Supreme Court has recognized as a rule, that a federal statute should not be construed to impair or supersede state insurance regulation absent a clear statement to that effect. It's a clear statement rule. It only follows that the SEC can't seize on purported ambiguities to expand its jurisdiction. It needs a clear statement. That's absent here.
If the SEC does exactly what they propose to do under this rule, doesn't that still leave the states a great deal of leeway for other regulation?
It does leave...
Is it in fact preemptive, in other words?
Pardon?
Is it in fact preemptive? Excuse me, go ahead.
Well, it does interfere directly and conflict directly to an extent with state law. And one example would be arbitration, which is required with broker-dealers under FINRA regulations and practices. And the Federal Arbitration Act ordinarily would preempt a state law that attempted to prohibit arbitration over those products. But once you throw in McCarran-Ferguson, there's a reverse preemption, and the insurance laws do require litigation rather than arbitration in disputes with insurance agents. This would defeat that requirement of state law, and I believe that Mr. Page, representing the state insurance commissioners, be prepared to talk about that more. But additionally, Judge Sentel, the court recognized in Valak that for the SEC to regulate these such products would, in fact, impinge on the states. It said we begin with a reluctance to superimpose federal requirements on state, on products that were tailored to satisfy state law. That's precisely what's being done here. In fact, I think one of the really extraordinary things about this rule is that one of its very foundations is the existence and presence of state regulation. You're not covered under this rule unless you are an annuity recognized as such by the state and regulated as such by the state. The rule's not even triggered absent that. It's a very extraordinary use of state law as a pretext for intruding in that area by the federal government. Another interference, Chief Judge Sentel, that I would mention is simply that the states have extensive requirements themselves already. If these federal requirements are superimposed, as the record reflects, they put an enormous additional cost on the insurance industry, which is something the states have an interest in functioning and offering.
Maybe that's a different question. That does not make it more interfering with state law than if it didn't. It will impose more costs. That would seem to be a given, that if you had two sets of regulations, there would be some additional costs.
And it will disenable the states from requiring litigation with agents over disputes, and also it will disempower states' ability to assert their own authority to the full extent and really assert control over these products, because the SEC will be in the background as an alternative regulatory authority, and insurance companies naturally are going to give less deference to the states than they do currently.
Excuse me. What is it about the rule, if I understood you correctly, that makes its application dependent upon state recognition of the product as an annuity?
Judge Ginsburg, if you look at the very first paragraph of the rule, a requirement of application of this rule is that it involve a contract that...
Is this in a summary?
Or yeah, I'm sorry. And it's at page A24 as the statutory appendix to our brief. But the language is that a contract that is... subject to regulation under the insurance laws of that jurisdiction as an annuity is nonetheless not an annuity contract if certain conditions are met. The other thing about this rule is that even if a product is an annuity that the SEC ultimately is prepared to say, oh, yes, that's a state law annuity, we don't have an interest in it, nonetheless, the computation requirements at the tail end of this very short rule require that a product that even the SEC would agree, oh, that's a state annuity, require that its value be computed in advance, 6 months in advance, according to a formula laid out in the rule. If you don't do that, even though you're otherwise an annuity subject only to state regulation, the SEC steps in. So this rule interferes directly with state regulation in that manner, too. Quickly on deference, you have the Board of Governors, the American Bankers case, which involved a very similar circumstance where an agency was trying to expand its jurisdiction based on a term outside of its authority. This court said no. Secondly, this court's decision in New York versus EPA, a decision written by Judge Rogers, you had statutory language that said any physical change. And this court said those words precluded interpretive discretion on the part of the agency. It couldn't pick and choose which products to regulate. And another extraordinary thing about this rule, where so little respect is shown to the states, their views, and the regulatory system, is that the SEC actually said that Section 3A8 exempts only, quote, certain annuities. And I believe that's on page 26 of the Joint Appendix. And it repeatedly said that it was going to regulate products that were indeed annuities. Finally, on deference, this court has said repeatedly that it will not defer to constructions of Supreme Court decisions that are given by agencies, because this court knows just as well how to interpret a court decision as an agency does. And yet, one of the very predicates of this rule was, as the SEC put it, their risk analysis is based on an application of the reasoning in the two Supreme Court decisions.
Let me ask you, in the Supreme Court cases where basically the court instructed that a functional approach is the way to look at these offerings to determine whether or not federal regulation is appropriate. Given that structure, and the court would look to Supreme Court instruction in that regard and then look at what the SEC has done, I understand your point about refrains in the rule about it doesn't really matter what the state law might require. But ignoring that for the moment in terms of responding to this question, what specifically do you think that the SEC has failed to do? Ignoring the Section 2B argument, too, if you will, for in answering this question.
What it's failed to do in this rulemaking?
Yeah, to the extent that the Supreme Court has said we want a functional approach. The SEC has offered its expert judgment as to the nature of the investment risk involved in these products and determined that there is a significant enough risk to the purchaser such that federal law should apply.
Yeah. I think first, Judge Rogers, I would say that they have failed to base this rule on the reality of annuities, both these products and traditional annuities as they exist in the market. This rule is based on theories that the SEC developed in its offices, but they're incompatible with reality in the rulemaking record. And let me mention.
Is that a different response to you just disagree with the SEC's definition of investment risk?
Yes, that is one element of the disagreement, but there's much more. And so as to their theory, one part of their theory was that if there are uncertainties as to the rate of return you'll get on a product, and if there's a link to the markets, that can't be an annuity. Those things.
Counsel, you're not going to assert that an agency cannot act based upon economic theories that it's worked out in its office, are you? I mean, this is, I think, twice at least, maybe three times you've told us that, but I'm not sure why that is disqualifying. That's what agencies do a lot, is work out theories in their office.
Well, what you had in this case was, let me respond first of all by saying, again, this is an unusual area where this state lacks the expertise. These are products by definition outside their authority. So they're theorizing.
That's the very issue we're here. You're begging the question then.
But their theories.
Can't allow it because this is outside their authority.
But my point is different. It's that
we're here to find out if it's within, to decide.
It's that the economic theories that they identify have to be consistent with reality. And their theory was essentially that if there's uncertainty as to the amount of return and if there's a link to the markets.
Then there is investment risk. And the question then becomes whose risk is, who is bearing the risk?
Well, but there's even the predicate that if there's uncertainty as to the returns or there's a link to the markets, that's incompatible with annuity is simply incorrect. This record showed, and
no, it's not correct or incorrect. Correct or incorrect is what we're here to decide, isn't it? You keep begging the question. I think when you say they're incorrect on this.
Well, I'm sorry, Chief Judge. I'm trying to complete the sentence.
I know that your position is that they're incorrect, but we can't decide they're incorrect just because they're incorrect. We have to have your reasoning along the way. And why isn't it their job to analyze investment risk and see who's bearing the risk in order to make that determination as to whether these are exempted annuities within the meaning of the statute?
The theory that they adopted is inconsistent with the reality of these products in the rulemaking record. Traditional fixed annuities also have uncertain rates of return. You buy a product, you know your rate of return in year one, but year two, three, four, you don't know what your rate of return will be. There is uncertainty with a traditional product. Additionally, traditional products can be indexed to the markets. In fact, what happened in this rulemaking was that the traditional issuers came in and said, we like the rule because you're imposing costs on our competitors by subjecting them to regulations. We're not. But, they said, our products also vary your rate of return year to year based on an index or based on our own portfolio. So that theory that that supposed risk is incompatible with annuity is just simply false. And the SEC hatched the theory in its offices without any expertise on these products and ignored significant rulemaking evidence. And I want to emphasize particularly the comments that were filed by the American Academy of Actuaries. This is 66 pages in the joint appendix. The SEC twice in footnotes in its adopting release said, this academy are experts. They're objective. They're independent. They said, we give their views substantial weight. But in these comments at pages 131, 127 to 128 and elsewhere, the academy said repeatedly, the risk profile of these products is very similar to traditional annuities. And they said variable annuities are very, very different. So here you have this expert body, 66 pages in the joint appendix, wholly ignored by the SEC because, again, they're engaged in theorizing.
The SEC said nothing in response to those comments?
They say nothing whatsoever, Your Honor. They do not address this comment except when it suits their purpose in another point. They cite them and say, these guys are real experts.
Except for mentioning them somewhere, they ignored them. Is that what you're telling me?
Pardon?
Except for mentioning them somewhere they ignored them?
Is that worse than ignored. When it suited their purpose, cited and said these guys are geniuses.
So they didn't ignore them. They liked part of them and disliked part of them.
Your Honor, on the central point in this rule, that is whether these products are like traditional annuities or like variables. They completely ignored them, even though they were aware of the comments. They said they were experts. It's actually an extraordinary thing to have an agency on the one hand say, this is a truly expert body, on the other hand, not even acknowledge what they've said on the key question of how these products function. The actuaries also criticized the theory of investment risk that the SEC had used. Also, the SEC repeatedly said that these products are very like variable annuities or mutual funds. They said that 7 different times in the adopting release, that they're unlike traditional annuities, they're very like mutual funds and variable annuities. The Academy of Actuaries said, not true, these are very like traditional annuities. The SEC has abandoned that particular theory in its brief.
You are over your time now.
Can I just ask one question, though? In your reply brief, you offer an example in the footnote on page 12 saying how a typical FIA's value is calculated. As I understand it, the SEC is focusing on the last paragraph. And I thought the argument here was in part, and I know it's in your briefs, that in allocating risk, the SEC, by using its more likely than not standard, had ignored the risk that the issuer bears. And then you point to the guarantees that the purchaser receives in connection with the principal and the rate of interest and the periodic interest. But it's that fourth paragraph, isn't it, that the SEC has been looking at in terms of defining whether or not there's a significant investment risk for the purchaser?
Your Honor and Chief Judge Sintel, I'll try to answer this briefly. I think that fourth paragraph is part of what they've attempted to address, but here's what they've conceded. They've conceded that the principal is a risk borne by the seller. They've conceded that the state-required minimum interest is a risk borne by the seller. And they've conceded that this indexed interest, which is the subject really of their rule, also is a risk borne by the seller. They did concede that on page 10 of their brief. And it is a risk borne by the seller.
Concede it where?
On page 10 of their brief. Yeah. Because if the index goes up, the insurer indisputably bears the burden of paying that interest. There is no case that has ever held that when a piece of an annuity is a risk borne by an insurer, it nonetheless must be treated as risk borne by the purchaser. And what's an additional failing here is that the commission purported to base this rule on a test of the allocation of risk. But I urge you to read their brief at pages 54 to 55 where they explain why it is that when a seller bears all of that risk and a purchaser bears this small amount of hypothetical risk, somehow the allocation is disproportionately in favor of the company. They never explain it, and that's the very essence of arbitrary and capricious decision making.
Actually, I thought you denied that that was even risk.
Pardon?
I thought what you just referred to as the small risk borne by the insured, elsewhere in your brief, you denied was risk at all.
To the purchaser, that's correct.
Yeah.
We would. It's putatively treated as a risk. And even supposing it were, the fact is it is a risk to the seller as well, which pre-commits to a fixed amount, or rather pre-commits to an amount that will have to pay at the end of the term. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the, let's see. Do we have an intervener scheduled for argument? I've mislaid my court sheet here somewhere.
Yes.
Okay, we'll hear from whoever's next. Do we have an extra copy of that court sheet?
Here.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sure it's here in this stack of paper somewhere, but you've all generated entirely too much paper this morning. So.
Sorry about that, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am Rodney Page, and I am appearing on behalf of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. I have not reserved time for rebuttal. We have petitioned this court to vacate the Rule 151A because we believe that the rule is an impermissible encroachment on the regulation of insurance by the states. It is specifically, we think, contrary to statutory directives. We think it's inconsistent with principles of federalism. and we submit that it was adopted in complete disregard for an existing regulatory regime at the state level with respect to FIAs. This rule, we believe, is a solution in search of a problem. When the rule was proposed, the SEC release stated that it was needed because of the need to enhance investor protection. And the proposing release described the marketing of FIAs as being fraudulent and abusive, and it sought comments with respect to how to regulate them. The proposing release made very little reference to the existing state regulatory scheme. What happened is, in the comment period, that the premise of the SEC turned out to be incorrect. The state regulatory environment dealing with these products is robust. There is regulation of a number of aspects of these products. There is non-forfeiture protection. There is regulation of the investment of funds, capital adequacy of the issuers. The products themselves are filed with and reviewed by state regulators. Advertising of the product is regulated. Disclosures about the product are required when they are sold. Suitability determinations have been incorporated at the state level, and other protections of that nature exist. Accordingly, the SEC, in dealing with this, shifted ground and in its final release stated that whether or not there was abuse and fraud in the marketplace was simply irrelevant to their determination. They would proceed on the assumption that there was a need for federal regulatory protection in the sale of the product. And they dismissed as irrelevant the existence of the state regulatory regime. We submit that in doing that, they have violated what we believe is a statutory commitment, committing these products to regulation of the states, and that, in fact, it is an unnecessary and inefficient rule. Most of the FIAs, an important fact that we noted in our reply brief, are actually regulated by a relatively small number of states. Two states account for about two-thirds of the premiums sold with respect to the FIAs. Those two states are Iowa and Minnesota, and they have among the most robust protection at the state level. We believe that the SEC, in proceeding with its rulemaking, essentially has misread the case law from the Supreme Court with respect to the role that the states should play with respect to regulation of these products. As Mr. Scalia also noted, the Supreme Court in Valak stated that it started with a reluctance to disturb state regulatory schemes that are in place. A key difference between what existed in the Supreme Court case in Valak and the case here is that, unlike this case, there was not an extensive regulatory scheme in place at the state level. We believe that Valak stands properly for the proposition that the existence of the state regulation is not dispositive to the federal questions, but we believe the SEC has misread this case in concluding that the state regulatory regime is irrelevant. What it should have done was look at the comments and evaluate the need for this regulation in light of what the actual marketplace looks like and what is actually going on in the market. Instead, what the SEC has done, we believe, is adopt the very proposition that the Supreme Court in Valak rejected, and that is the notion that concepts of insurance and insurance regulation are static and frozen and do not evolve over time. The opinion in Valak made it clear that that is not the case. What the SEC has done itself in this case is adopt exactly what the Supreme Court rejected. It has chosen to treat state insurance as being solely about the question of insolvency of the companies and not recognizing that, in fact, state regulation has gone far beyond that. What is required for this rule is a balancing of state and federal interests, and the SEC failed to do that. For that reason, we ask you to vacate this rule.
You're not making a constitutional federalism argument, are
no.
you? No. Okay, good. Thank you. Hear from the respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Michael Conley for the SEC. I plan to address two main points this morning. First, why this rule reflects precisely the sort of interpretation of an ambiguous statutory term that's reviewed for reasonableness under Chevron, and second, why the line that the Commission drew in this rule is in fact a reasonable one and therefore should be upheld. I'll first address why Chevron deference is appropriate here. This rulemaking is just the latest in a series of efforts by the Commission and courts over the past 50 years to address how the exemption in Section 388 of the Securities Act for annuity contracts applies to new forms of annuities that didn't exist when that exemption was enacted. The bottom line is this, based on VALIC, United Benefit, and the cases that have followed them, we know that there's a spectrum along which annuity contracts fall. At one end is the traditional fixed annuity, which is clearly insurance and clearly entitled to the exemption under 388. At the other end of the spectrum are variable annuities, which are clearly securities and clearly not entitled to the exemption under 388. But between these two poles is a gray area that's occupied by products like the flexible fund annuity that the court addressed in United Benefit and the indexed annuities that are the subject of this rule. And the Supreme Court, other courts, and the Commission have all recognized that these sorts of hybrid products, which have aspects of both insurance and securities, when you're talking about these things, the application of the annuity contract exemption is ambiguous. As Judge Easterbrook said when he wrote about this for the Seventh Circuit in the Home Life case, neither the statute nor the Supreme Court draw any bright line that tells us where these hybrid annuity products fall, whether they're entitled to the exemption or not. Ultimately, then, whether such a product is entitled to the exemption depends upon a judgment about the investment risks that it presents and whether it presents risks that implicate the protections of the securities laws. That's what courts have been doing since VALIC. It's what the Commission did more than 20 years ago when it adopted Rule 151. And it's exactly what the Commission did in this case, too. It made a judgment based on the factors that the court identified in VALIC and United Benefit that the class of indexed annuity contracts that are addressed by this rule present investment risk that Congress would not have intended to leave solely to state insurance regulation. The Commission reasoned that the purchasers of these products are exposed, by definition, to market volatility, and that that implicates the securities law's protective purposes. And it's based on that judgment that the Commission concluded that these products are not annuity contracts as defined by Section 388. And under settled law, this is exactly the kind of determination that is reviewed for reasonableness, which is what I'll turn to now. And basically here, the petitioners have made three principal challenges to the reasonableness of the Commission's judgment. First, they say it's based on an understanding of investment risk that's fundamentally flawed. Second, they say that it doesn't account adequately for the amount of risk that's borne by the insurance companies under these contracts. And finally, they talk about the Commission having failed adequately to consider how these products are marketed. And as Your Honors will see in the release, the Commission dealt with each of these arguments and explained why they don't have merit. I'm going to turn first now to the biggest argument, which is with respect to whether, in fact, the Commission has a reasonable understanding of investment risk here. And the petitioners argue, and they've repeated this morning, that investment risk exists or is cognizable for these purposes only where there's the potential to lose principal. And the problem with that, the Commission explained how that's not an adequate understanding of investment risk or a complete understanding of investment risk, but it's also contrary to the position that every single case that's been decided since United Benefit is taken. All of those cases, every one, involved contracts in which there was a guarantee of principal plus a guarantee return of interest. What those cases all dealt with was whether uncertainties with respect to payments beyond principal and interest were such that it made the contract ineligible for the Section 388 exemption.
These are not Supreme Court cases, then?
Those are not Supreme Court cases, Your Honor. However, I'll note also that in the United Benefit case, the contract that was at issue there also provided for, after a 10-year period of time, a full return of premiums paid or net premiums paid. But the cases that followed it We're addressing contracts that the insurance industry developed in response to Supreme Court decisions. And yet in each of those cases, the court was looking at whether this extra component, whether it's extra interest, excess interest, which is sometimes referred to, whether there was enough uncertainty about that, that investment risk was presented that made these things ineligible for Section 3A8. And some cases found that it did, and some cases found that it didn't, depending on the nature of the...
Excuse me, but the United Benefit is the case in which the Supreme Court said the return, the risk component, was dependent upon the insurance company's management of a portfolio, didn't it?
It's true, Your Honor, that in the Valak case, a particular kind of contract that was presented was a variable annuity. Mm. And the way that contract functions, the Supreme Court did identify that there were many ways in which it looked like an investment company. But what the Supreme Court didn't say was that the only kind of risk that was relevant would be if a contract presented that particular kind of risk. Instead, the broader position that was taken was, is there something about the contract that are the risks that are presented there that make the securities laws relevant, that make the protections of the securities laws relevant? And then the court went on to actually analyze the particular contract and identify that as one of the risks.
Looking at this contract, is it conceded, I think it is, that there is no risk on the investor as the principal?
That's correct.
That there is a fixed return that is not at risk. It is the over and above is all that is at risk.
Well, the way these contracts...
If that's risk.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The way these contracts work is that there is a minimum guarantee that's provided.
Yeah.
And then there's the potential to participate in this market-related returns. And we tried to explain in our brief, these are very complicated instruments.
Yeah. But we got that part.
Okay. Yeah, that's clear. And the guaranteed return only kicks in if at the point that the person leaves the contract, either by surrendering it or coming to the end of the term, if the returns from the market component don't exceed what the minimum guarantee is. So it's slightly different than these traditional excess interest contracts.
I'm not sure how that is different in kind.
Well, it's...
And if it's a guaranteed return, the fact that you can only draw it at the end as opposed to... It can only be computed at the end. Incrementally, you've been getting it all the time, perhaps, but nonetheless, it is a guaranteed return.
That's correct. It's a guarantee of principal.
The only thing that can be called risk at all is the over and above what's guaranteed.
That's correct. And
does that sound real risky? What's the?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, that's actually the exact way that all of these other cases, every contract that was dealt with in these cases, worked. Because really, all you
say some of them have gone one way and some have gone the other way.
Well, that's with respect to how the particular, and that's where we come into the thing that's critical here. What in the Home Life case, Judge Easterbrook explained why some cases went one way and why some cases went the other. And what he said is that the way to understand it, to rationalize these decisions, basically, is to pay attention to how the determination is made about what the rate to be paid will be. And in the cases where the determination was made prospectively, where the investor knew in advance what he or she was going to receive over the period, that was a sufficient assumption of risk by the insurance company, and those cases were found to satisfy the requirements of 3A8. Where, however, the determination of the rate was not made until after a period elapsed, retrospectively, which is exactly how these contracts work in this case, then the courts concluded that the purchaser bore the risk, too much of the investment risk, and the contracts were ineligible for Section 3A8.
Does the purchaser here have the ability to calculate that minimum return that is guaranteed at the time of purchase?
That is a calculation that presumably could go forward. But remember,
I think that is a yes.
Yes, but that's true. That was true in all these other contracts as well.
I think that's in the sales materials.
I'm sorry.
I believe that would be in the sales materials.
That's true. The sales materials presumably
The insurer doesn't have to calculate it. It's part
there.
Of the part of the policy.
Prospectively, it's been calculated.
But what the purchaser of the contract cannot do, which is exactly what all the cases that found 3A8 not being satisfied concluded, they can't tell what the return will be in the coming period because it's linked to the uncertain performance of a security or securities
index. Well, the excess return, as we've been calling it. In other words, they can look at it and say, well, we'll get whatever state law gives us, 1% to 3%. Whether we'll get any more is uncertain.
That's true. Right. That's true. But again, that's exactly the same as all these other contracts that
now,
the contracts that were at issue in and that the court described in Home Life.
Let me pick up there. Home Life's the Easterbrook opinion.
Yes, that's
yes,
Easterbrook.
So starting opinion. There, if the rate of return for the coming year on this fluctuating tranche is determined retrospectively based on the performance of the market or some index for the prior year. And during the first 10 years or so, it's impractical for the insured to abandon the policy because of the surrender charge. What difference does it make whether the calculation is prospective instead made prospective?
Well, the difference that it makes is that the purchaser of the contract simply lacks the information to be able to make the judgment that you're talking about.
About whether to abandon?
About whether to abandon.
Well, the surrender charge, I mean, they haven't earned, they're starting at about 87%.
That's correct.
Right, vested, and they haven't earned back the other 13% for some years.
Well, it depends on the performance of the index prior to that time. Because as soon as the index performs positively, and this is materials we cited in our brief and were cited in the release, under most of these contracts, under all of these contracts that we know of, then what essentially happens is the minimum guarantee almost becomes irrelevant. Because once there's a positive return, the surrender charge dropped from that after a relatively short period of time would be in excess of the minimum. So there are circumstances in which it's going to be extremely relevant for the purchaser to be able to know what the return is going to be in the coming year and be able to make a judgment, a realistic judgment, based on all the information that he or she has about whether to stay in the contract or not. This isn't just a hypothetical thing that could never be meaningful. It really can be meaningful in exactly the way that Judge Easterbrook talked about. Because when you have prospective setting of rates, what happens effectively is that the contract becomes a series of one-year fixed annuities. The purchaser, or whatever the particular period happens to be, we're using 1 year as an example, but then at the start of each period, the purchaser is free at that time, has sufficient information to decide whether to stay in the contract or not. When the purchaser doesn't have that, he faces or she faces what's the precise ex ante uncertainty that Judge Easterbrook referred to Home Life.
Suppose that by your concept of risk,
yes,
which is the risk that you will not get the excess at all, that there'll be a zero for the coming year.
Well, it's the risk that you're going to get less than what the expected return would be.
Well, there is no expected return.
Well, there is an expected return because, I mean, you can calculate an expected return, like you can for any product that has an uncertain future return. And investors don't buy these products, of course, with an anticipation of simply getting the guaranteed minimum. The reason they choose these products...
Well, I don't know that we have a record on that question.
I'm sorry?
I'm not sure there's a record on that, what people do when... how they buy these things.
There actually is a record, and the commission refers to information that was provided by some of the sellers of these contracts, which say that a substantial percentage of them are buying these products not just for the guarantee, but for the possibility of earning more than the guarantee. Otherwise, they would be buying, I mean, just logically, otherwise they'd be buying traditional fixed annuities, which pay a higher guaranteed rate. The reason that you're willing to accept a lower rate here...
With this concept of risk, which is the risk that you'll get less than the expected, that you've the return that you've calculated
the uncertainty
on a probability basis.
Yes.
On that concept, if the policy were not to have this excess tranche, but rather to say every year we will give you some lottery tickets, they may not pay off. That would also be an impermissible risk.
Well, obviously the particular contracts that we're talking about here are limited to three circumstances that have to exist. There has to be this retrospective crediting, there has to be a link to a security or a securities index, and it has to be more likely than not the returns coming there.
I'm not suggesting the commission would assert jurisdiction over policies
right.
that are accompanied by a flow of gratuitous lottery tickets.
Yes.
On the ground that they're securities, although I wouldn't be surprised.
But
I am saying that the concept of risk that you're using here would apply equally there, forgetting whether that would make it into a security.
The risk of uncertain future return is a well-established notion of risk, yes.
And would apply in my hypothetical.
I assume that some version of that, there's a similar risk that you could say exists there. Except that, I mean, it really is critical to note that the risk here is a risk that's linked to uncertain market performance. I mean, you really are
talking about the lottery ticket is linked to an uncertainty as well.
I'm sorry?
A lottery ticket has a substantial uncertainty.
Yes, but the uncertainty that's here is an uncertainty that's common to securities, generally. And it's part of what makes investing in securities something that the securities laws relate to, the protection of the securities laws relate to. And once again, I'll bring back...
You have a sort of uncertainty with respect to any annuity in that if it's surrenderable at all, you make the decision every year on whether the investment you have in that annuity could render a greater return in some other form. I realize not all of them are surrenderable, but if it can be surrendered, then you have to make that same decision. All that's changed here is that part of that market is already tacked onto the side of it, but you would always have an investor, if it's a surrenderable annuity.
You're exactly right.
And potentially put the money in something else. Does that make all of them investments?
The critical point, though, Your Honor, is whether you have all the information that's necessary to be able to make that decision.
You never have all the information that's necessary to make
that decision. You have enough information to be able to make what we would call an informed investment decision, which is what the securities laws relate to.
Why don't you have the same information here? Because the decision otherwise is whether to take the money, if it can be surrendered, or if it has to be renewed and you're deciding whether to renew, if you could take that money and put it somewhere else and make a greater return. You're making a market prediction when you make that decision, just as you would be with a CD as to whether you would at the close of it. Here, you're making the same decision, only you have a little more information. You know that you're going to have some key to...
Actually, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the information that you don't have here is what the return will be for that component of
the
contract.
That's the information that you don't have when you're making a surrender decision or renewal decision.
No, you would have that in contract.
You don't know what's going to be happening in the future market.
No, but you know what you will be earning under this particular product for that period. What is removed is the uncertainty of the future return. And when you have that, that's exactly what courts have found.
Somehow we're missing each other on my hypothetical comparison.
I think I have your point. It's that in one instance you're saying, well, under the policy, I'm going to earn 5% for the coming year. Do I want to surrender the policy and go into the market?
Correct.
Versus under the policy, I'm not sure what I'm going to get. I'm just sure of the minimum, 3, and I have to decide whether to go into the market instead.
That's exactly right.
That's a fairly narrow difference in risk, isn't it, counsel? You're not risking anything that you have. You're risking how much you can make on what you have.
But that's an essential element of risk in the sense of uncertain future return, which is described as investment risk generally.
Well, why did the Academy of Actuaries describe the risk profile then of this product as being essentially similar to that of a conventional annuity?
The discussion that was made there was talking about what insurance companies do in order to respond to the risk that's presented. And they said because there is a guaranteed minimum in this contract, to the extent that the contract functions in that way, and they have to cover that guaranteed minimum, they're making very similar investments to what they would do in a fixed annuity. But that really doesn't address the risk that we're talking about here, which is the risk of uncertainty with respect to the purchaser's risk of uncertainty with respect to the return that's going to be made.
On the insurance company side, there are different but similar strategies for hedging that risk.
That's correct.
Buying an index, for instance.
That's correct. Right. Okay. That's the difference here between fixed annuities and that, and the insurance company responds to that exactly as you said, by purchasing hedging contracts and so on in order to address it.
Well, all of which, whatever they do is essentially irrelevant to your concerns. It's a solvency issue.
That the insolvency issue in the fixed annuity context, right, is what state law relates to. I would like, if I can, have just a brief moment to respond to this point on state law, because I think it's a significant one that the Supreme Court has actually considered this and rejected the precise argument that's being made by petitioners here. I would urge Your Honors to look at the Valak decision. The paragraph that they refer to, the portion of Justice Douglas's opinion at the beginning, which says that we're reluctant to to enter into the area of insurance, which is traditionally the purview of states, there's a paragraph that follows that, which says, but we have to do so because in this case, the issue before us was what the meaning is under federal law. And of course, then the concurring opinion said specifically that this notion that because these issues, because state insurance regulation exists of these products, and of course the other thing that's correct here is that these products were subject to state insurance regulation at that time, the products in Valak, that that's enough. We don't have to worry basically about these. We'll let the state insurance regulators deal with whatever problems might arise with respect to new contracts. That was squarely rejected. And in fact, the author of the dissenting opinion in Valak was Justice Harlan. And Justice Harlan, who wrote for the unanimous court.
You are over your time. So
I do have one.
Let's make this. If you're going to say something else about that, say something brief about it.
Okay, I will.
You
Justice
don't
Harlan.
Want to hear about Harlan's further history or what his granddaddy wrote or anything like that.
Okay, I promise. Justice Harlan acknowledged in United Benefit that this argument was squarely rejected by the court.
But as I understand the argument in part, it's that at the time he wrote, that was an accurate description. But since then, states have done a lot more. So the argument that state law does not address investment techniques and that type of thing is no longer valid. And the commission, as I read its explanation, simply says, we don't care what the states are doing because it could be less than a uniform requirement, and the disclosure that federal law provides and the protections under federal law should exist irrespective. So the argument is made, hypothetically, if all the states were doing everything that sort of the federal law would require under the application of this rule, would the commission be venturing into an area where it has no authority to venture unless Congress gives it?
2 points, if I can, to respond to that. First, the notion that state law is comprehensive and uniform here is simply not borne out by the record, as we've said. The second point, though, is that the Supreme Court actually did address this very point and say that what is relevant for these purposes is whether securities laws are relevant to the risk that's presented. And if states move into this area, that Congress fully contemplated concurrent regulation by states and the federal government. So that's in the Supreme Court opinion. That's the authority.
Mr. Connolly.
Yes.
I have one other concern. And that's with the commission's analysis of the effect of the rule on competition and
yes.
capital formation and so on, which is relevant only if we agree with you to this point on everything that's been said to this point.
Correct.
That analysis has, as one of the factors on which the commission depended, the resolution of the uncertainty now prevailing over the legal status of these products.
That's correct.
I don't see how that can possibly be relevant to the analysis that's required by the statute, in other words, you can't say, well, competition will be improved because we've messed it up by dawdling over this issue or by saying we might regulate it, and now we're resolving the uncertainty, and that will improve competition. For one thing, it would be true whether no matter how you resolve the uncertainty.
Your Honor, I think if I understand the point,
it's pretty simple.
Right, that resolution of the uncertainty about how these products have been regulated will have the effect of making it clear
that would be true no matter what you decided. That simply supports the making of a decision. What Judge Ginsburg, I think, is suggesting is it doesn't support the making of the decision one way or the other. It can't be part of the reasoning as to why we decided this in a particular way. It simply says we should decide this, get it over with.
That's correct, and that has an effect. Yes. That has an effect, and I think that was the point.
That can't be relevant to the analysis of the effect of the rule. Of the rule, not of resolution. Just that's the effect of just getting this done one way or the other.
If you decided exactly the opposite, it would be equally true.
I see your point.
It doesn't say that the rule is good for competition or well, that's what it claims. And that's one of the factors on which the commission based its analysis, which takes us to Chenery. And my further question, which I assume if I'm right, that's one of the factors we would have to recommit this to the agency to reconsider that?
Well, I don't believe that's the case for two reasons, Your Honor. First, I think that we've made the argument, it's before the court, obviously, that the Section 2B requirement to undertake this analysis didn't apply in this.
That's your argument in the brief, but your rulemaking document says, here's the required 2B analysis.
That's correct.
All right, so it's a little late to be switching your interpretation of whether 2B applies. You applied it.
And the essence of the Commission's explanation for why the analysis that had to be undertaken with respect to comparison to state law, which is really the only objection that was raised here by petitioners. The only objection they make is that the Commission didn't do this comprehensive analysis of state law and say what extra was being added here and whether that was necessary. And the Commission said that to do so, to allow them to use this general provision in this way, would contravene what the Supreme Court said in United Benefit and VALIC about the relationship between state law and whether a security is entitled to an exemption under Section 3A8.
Well, that's another point that I was going to get to about the competitive analysis or the competition, capital formation, and so on analysis. And that is that one can't say whether something is beneficial to competition, let's say, without saying compared to what. So if compared to not promulgating the rule, that means leaving the state regime in place. So without knowing what the marginal effect is, in other words, of promulgating the rule, you haven't analyzed addressed the requirement of 2B.
But I would come back to the point that I just made, I think, is the response to that, which is that it cannot be the case that the Commission is required to undertake this particular kind of an analysis as part of a general provision that would contravene what the Supreme Court has said is the correct relationship between
state
law.
Well, no. You may conclude it will have an adverse effect on capital formation and competition, but we have to do it. But you didn't do the analysis.
I believe the Commission actually said there that the state laws that are out there and the improvements that have recently been made by states in this area are commendable, but they can't ultimately substitute for the comprehensive, complete protections that are required for securities. And if securities require these protections, then without regard to what the states are doing, those requirements are still in place. And they can't be superseded by, and it doesn't mean that these things are not securities and that purchasers of these products are not entitled to the same protections.
I understand. You're making the legal response to a statute that puts you in the unusual position of making an economic response. And it hasn't sat well with the Commission ever since it's been passed. It was ignored for 10 years, and then finally in the Investment Company Act cases, the court twice remanded it so you would actually do it. But let me ask you this. Mr. Scalia said, if I understood correctly, that is the Commission's position, and I'm not sure this is correct, that if we find the rule is invalid, that it should be vacated rather than remanded.
That's not the Commission's position.
Okay. Then it follows, I trust, that if we find the competition analysis, the 2B analysis, is insufficient, again, you would think it should not be vacated, but rather left in place while remanded.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, I hate to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to bring up another aspect. Mr. Scalia says that the Commission did not respond to an important area of comment, the actuary's comments. Now, it is normally the rule that we do require rulemakings to respond to important comments. So what do you say to his argument in that regard?
I think that the Commission in the release did respond to this position that these products are more like fixed annuities than they are variable annuities by explaining that although a part of these products looks like that, there is an important part that doesn't. And the Commission responded even more importantly in structuring the way that the rule works when in fact these products are functioning more like fixed annuities, traditional fixed annuities, then the rule does not make the exemption unavailable. In other words, when it's more likely than not that the return is going to be the guaranteed minimum, then the exemption is not unavailable. And so that directly responds to the point about how these contracts are structured and when they resemble traditional fixed annuities.
So you're saying at most you may not have mentioned them in that connection, but you
responded
correct. In substance.
That's correct. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You had used all your time. We'll give you back 3 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Scalia.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Give intervener one in a minute. Go ahead.
Pardon me?
Go ahead with your three. I'm going to give them one in a minute.
With respect, first of all, to the actuary's report, the commission never responded to the actuary's point that from an actuarial risk-bearing perspective, these products put all the same risk, in fact, slightly more on a company as compared to a traditional annuity. They never addressed
that. That's on the company side.
Pardon me?
That's on the company side.
That's correct.
But if I understood Mr. Conley, your objection here is on the insured's side, the risk. You object to their saying that the insured is bearing risk.
Well, it's both, Your Honor. The question, they said the hinge of our rule is allocation of risk. They said there's been an improper transfer of risk to the purchaser. Part of that analysis is, well, does the seller bear the same amount of risk that he bears otherwise? One case they've completely ignored is the Open case.
Well, no, wait a minute. The seller could bear the same amount of risk as otherwise, and yet the insured bears a risk, a new risk, not otherwise borne, because this is a riskier product. There's more risk to go around.
Well, and it's the commission's job to explain why, if it's risk, and I'd like to address that briefly, why it's so serious to trump the product's annuity character. They never explained that. They just said, oh, we found some risk. And let me emphasize the United Benefit decision, which did not turn on a conclusion that there was too much risk on the purchaser. Instead, the court said it would be error to think that VALIC turned only on that. And Judge Ginsburg, as you pointed out, it focused on two other things. It looked first to state law and said these products are exempt from state risk requirements. That was important to the analysis. And the second thing it looked at was whether there was an investment management relationship, which Judge Ginsburg, you had noted, and all of the other cases that have been cited involved a circumstance where the purchaser was committing funds for management for profit by the seller. So in the Home Life Easterbrook decision, for example, the returns that the purchaser got were, quote, derived from, quote, the returns of the seller, and the court characterized the product as a variable annuity. The Open case has been completely ignored by the SEC. That's a case just like this, where there was a formula set in advance. The purchaser didn't know what the rate of return would be, nor did the seller, but the seller committed
Which
to pay.
Which case, I'm sorry?
It's the Open, 10th Circuit case, and what the SEC is inviting is a conflict between this court, the 10th, and the 7th on one side, and the 10th on the other, that's unnecessary, because Open said, because the company pre-commits, it's taking risk, and that's sufficient. And again, certainly Judge Easterbrook said it's like a series of fixed annuities, but there's no legal requirement that there be a series of fixed annuities. That's like saying all annuities must be traditional, which isn't the rule. Again, that case was...
But mostly said there's no... We have not yet said how much risk is too much risk, and I'm not sure that I knew when we got through what he still thought was too much risk.
Well, and what VALIC and United Benefit both make clear is that the rule is not that there can be no risk borne by the purchaser, but that's, at the end of the day, what this rule depends on. VALIC, at page 71, says very clearly, we're interested in a particular kind of risk, the risk of no fixed returns. The SEC has interpreted its mandate to find any kind of risk. Your lottery example, Your Honor, remember, the way this rule functions is if it's only if you're more likely than not to get more than the guarantee that the rule applies. If I sell you a product with a 20% chance of a 10% guarantee and a 40% chance of 2%, the SEC doesn't care. It's only if I give you a 95% chance of a 2% return that the rule kicks in. That's absurd. Finally, on the subject of vacating the rule, I'd like to be clear. The SEC has never said that it agrees, and I did not mean to say that. Don't believe it. It has never, until this moment, said that the rule shouldn't be vacated. It's waived its opposition to vacating the rule. But in any event, the APA itself, as Chief Judge Sentell, you know, says that if the rule is invalid, shall
you,
be vacated.
You know that I have said they should vacate the rule and so many
That's
other
correct. Times. I'm not addressing every member of the panel at this moment. But additionally, there has been extensive evidence put before the commission and the court about how this rule will radically alter this industry, impose enormous costs that must be going to be incurred now. If
we have let you go well beyond the 3 minutes that I ceded to you, so unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll give the intervener a minute if they want it.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
They're not asking for it. Therefore, we will take a brief recess.